Hello and welcome to IT Conversations. I'm your host, Doug Kay, and today we have a recorded session from BloggerCon 3 held at Stanford University on November 6, 2004. This session is on academia, and the session leader is Jay Rosen.
Okay, well, that's pretty cool, right? A lot of different disciplines, some of them science, some of them humanities-based, some of them public communication, as in journalism. Let's take about 10 minutes, and I want to hear from you, and our microphone helpers are going to help us, right, Scott?
Yeah.
What other questions should be on our list? Don't give me an answer. Give me a question. Phrase it as a question. Like in Jeopardy, if you don't phrase it as a question, like the buzzer goes off. So what other questions should we have on our list?
Why isn't there a relationship between blogging and other instructional technologies like course management systems?
Why isn't there a relationship?
They seem to be living in parallel worlds where there's bloggers and people who use things like Blackboard and WebCT and alike on the campus, and why aren't they closer tied?
Okay. Sorry, Dave, could you add to our list here? This one's blogging versus Blackboard and the relationship between them. Because Blackboard is pretty popular on campus, but people don't realize they could use blog for what they do, right? Okay. Wait for the mic.
That pen is worthless.
I use the purple one.
My question is, how, if at all, can blogging affect Publish or Perish?
Publish or Perish, which is the...
Especially given that the number of publishing outlets are shrinking and the publishing demands on academics are not shrinking for tenure, things like that.
Okay. So blogging and Publish or Perish. That's good.
My question is, how does blogging and other things like digital libraries affect the value of university?
The value?
The value of attending university.
The value of attending university. Say a little more. I'm not quite clear.
You can, because now a lot of the things that you could only find at an academic institution, like a research library and stuff, is being disseminated. Digital library, blogging, people can communicate, so that's that.
Okay, so in an era of blogging, why do we need the university at all? Right? Why do we need the university if we have all these other ways of disseminating knowledge? Good. I'll get to you next.
Jim Zellmer. My sister is just finishing up her tenure track at the University of Minnesota, and during this election cycle, she sent me a letter that I could blog, written by some Harvard and I think Stanford economic professors on the bad attributes of Bush's economic policy. And I said, well, why don't you just post it? And she said, well, they're saying for non-tenured people they shouldn't post it. And I just was curious about, you know, all of the politics of these things, and I'm sure that exists in different aspects of academia. So I thought
I'd pass that on. That's part of Publish or Perish.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. And the potentially disruptive effects of blogging for promotion and advancement in the university. Right. Good.
Well published, which is interesting.
Yeah. This gentleman was next, and then we'll come back around to you two guys, and we'll get you two.
How can blogging or blogging technology be made to be more attractive to academics?
Okay, how do we make it attractive to academics? That's a good question. And then these two guys.
So what types or styles of blogging make sense for academics? So, you know, for example, your blog is a bit different than Brad DeLong's blog, but then completely differently, one might have a blog where the intended audience really is only one's academic colleagues, for example.
Yes. Right. So, that's really a question about the proper audience for academic blogs, right? What should be the audience? What's DeLong's blog called again?
I'll tell you in a second.
We should get a couple other academic blogs up. Okay, so what's the proper audience? That's good.
Dan Mitchell from De Anza College. I'm actually more interested in the use of blogs as learning tools by students. and not purely as publishing kinds of tools for academics.
Okay, so learning tools of students, do you mean in use in a course, or do you...
Use by students, for example, in terms of collaborating on a blog as in a writing course, if
okay.
you will, or in a journalism course, or using it in place of a journal, those kinds of... There's a whole bunch of uses for that.
Okay, so blogging as a learning tool for students. How do we make blogging effective as a learning tool for students? That's what you want to know, right? Yeah. Okay.
I'm Lisa. How do we make blogging an effective learning tool for the professions as well? Removing journalists as middleman, connecting academia to the applied in medicine, in law, in journalism, even in parenthood, frankly.
Okay, so, right. So blogging can create a direct connection between professional expertise and users, right, without going through the media.
Yes.
So how do we, yeah. realize that vision. Okay, good.
Hi, I'm Paul. What tools can academic bloggers use that will solve some of their unique problems? For example, if you're a mathematician or a scientist and you have to express things that don't fit really well in ASCII without having to sort of embed giant images.
Say that again, I'm not sure.
What tools can academic bloggers, such as mathematicians or scientists, use so they can express themselves for things that don't fit really well in ASCII, like big equations or stuff like that?
ASCII?
Plain text.
Plain text.
So there are format issues in graphical.
I gotcha. Right.
It's not, if you're a math student, right, and you're watching a professor write formulas down the board, it's not efficient to type that. You can't type that as fast as you can write it. Well, most people can't. I mean, and so there are related issues that make this a stumbling block for some disciplines adopting blogging.
Gotcha. Okay. So disciplinary stumbling blocks to... Yeah, this is how to get beyond disciplinary stumbling blocks in blogging technology, right, that prevents some disciplines from easily using it. Law professors don't have this problem, right, but mathematicians do, scientists might. I get it now. Let's do one more, and then we'll start to tackle some of
these. Dave Harper, I'm a little curious that as all these professors and students are using blogs and publishing, what possible aggregation tools that are maybe unique to that... educational setting needs to be developed so people get more access to the specific user-generated content that they need without reading them on a regular basis or sorting through them all.
Okay, aggregation tools for academic blogging to make it more accessible and productive, right? One more? This would be the final question. We'll simply start thinking about some of these.
From a policy perspective, I'd like to know what the university should do in terms of a strategy or plan of action in adopting this blogging technology. I think a lot of university officials understand how blogs can benefit, but they're not sure how to proceed. So I'd like to identify a plan of action, if possible.
Interesting. Okay, good. Okay, here's my first question for you. It has to do with the one I wrote down, the first one I wrote down. For those of you who have an academic background or are part of that institution, what is the promise of blogging for academics? Why do it? What's the why should people in the university take seriously blogging, and why should they become bloggers themselves? What do you think?
Taking a look at what academia is and how it's formed, it seems to be based around publication and peer review. And the mechanism for publication is the printing press. And it's not the same to move academia into the digital age just to make PDF files of those journals. It seems as though the internet and blogging potentially can offer a new way of performing academia and publication and peer review that expands beyond the limited resources of these print journals.
Okay, so one reason is simply more distribution, right? Wider audience, bigger world. Is that what you're saying?
The The previous guidelines for academia through these print journals were based on limited resources, that printing was expensive, and you had to limit it based upon the expense of printing. But now there's no such scarcity, and so it seems as though blogging can allow for a much wider range of discourse.
Okay, so it's post-scarcity world is brought to us by blogging, and that's important for academics, right? Okay, good. Why should academics blog? That's our question right now.
It has an effect of making it an open classroom.
How so? Go on.
Well, they're blogging in a professional sense and blogging for the students and students to students blogging, which is a learning process itself, which is a very dynamic process.
Okay, so it's just an effective classroom tool. That's one reason, right? Effective classroom tool. Good. Let's use two people for the. Yeah,
my name is Eric Nee. I work at Stanford Law School, and Larry Lessig at the law school is, I think, an example of the effective use of blogging to take ideas which might have been confined to the academic world, or in his case, I mean, his book turned out to be pretty popular, but I think his blog has enabled him to really disseminate his ideas in the wider community in a way that was not possible before. So it's an effective way for ideas which used to be confined within the academy to really reach a popular audience rapidly and then engage them in dialogue.
Yeah, and that's a very powerful thing and might change the university a lot because we haven't had that idea before that professors can have a public audience, presumably not a part of the institution. And now it's definitely true. So that's going to be a very disruptive thing. It's great for Larry. It's great for me. I have a lot more readers than I used to for that reason. This guy. Go ahead. Who do we have on this side? Nope. Oh, okay, we'll start over here.
So the question is, why blog? And when I do hiring, I really want to look at somebody's blog. And academic credentials are starting to mean a lot less to me. I see some really impressive academic credentials. But if I have someone who has a good blog, I can see the way that they're thinking. And so academics blog, we're jumping past all these certificates that you're earning, giving out.
Yeah.
And all the thought processes and things that we think that we're giving people and that we're guaranteeing with that degree, and I'm jumping past that. The degree just becomes a lot less important.
Interesting. I noticed this when I want to tell people like what I do, what I'm involved in. It's simple. I just send them one URL. There you have me, my world, my life, my mind, and that's new. That's definitely a new thing. And so blogging can sum up an academic's work and become a way to visit it, or anybody can visit it. And that's certainly a new condition. Raise your hand. Go ahead.
Sort of a counterpoint to the question about the open classroom. In many cases, the role of content management systems is to prevent the open classroom and to prevent the dissemination of information outside the limited number of people who are formally enrolled in the class. Perhaps in that sense, and I'm being a devil's advocate here, obviously, perhaps academics shouldn't blog openly.
The argument for why they shouldn't would be what? Say it again.
Would be that the university has an interest in preventing people who are not paid students from getting information. That's the primary role of content management systems at many universities.
Yes, so if the university's value added is that it is a place where knowledge and information is captured and held, then won't blogging destroy that value by making it potentially available to anybody, whether you're paying or not? That's why academics shouldn't blog. Right? Okay. Next here, and then we'll go here.
I th- think there are maybe two notions here about what we're talking about when we say academic blogging. And one notion seems to be pretty prevalent in this room is that it's blogging by university professors. And another notion that I have some sympathy with being from the community college system, and I think I hear some others with that, is that it's also about the role of blogging in teaching and learning, a more of a student-focused kind of notion of this. And I think there might be a way to bridge those two notions. And one, I'm hearing, for example, students A can blog, and students B have access to materials that they can use in their own studies and that they can then comment on, for example, in their own blogs. And also the notion that academic publishing, I heard someone say, traditionally may be limited by cost. And when the publishing starts to be web-based through a blog or something else, the cost issue is no longer a problem, which also means that those resources that are created there are much more widely available. So that a student, for example, in a community college course that I teach may have more ready access to the kinds of, if you will, academic publications that you're talking about that they might not normally have access to or comment on. And that this can promote in a whole variety of ways a much more connected kind of publishing and reading and commentary that's not limited to I think the university world, if you will, or the world of high school education, the world of community college, and so on. So I think there's a lot that can happen that's enabled by blogging that makes us think about this in a rather different way.
Okay, so part of our discussion is sort of publishing. That part, right? And then the other part is teaching and learning. And blogging is potentially revolutionary in both, right? Because publishing and...
And there is a connection between the two.
Yeah. I've noticed this. Certain blog posts that I've done that are long and have a lot of links in them, I realized after I did them, are basically a course. Basically a course, because if everybody looked at every link and read every link, it would be a syllabus. And so I have certain blog posts that are a syllabus. And one of the things I'm waiting for is a good tool, maybe there is one, I just don't know about it, where I could click and see all the links in my post organized just that. I don't have that. I asked for it in the next generation of Bluebolt type, but I don't think they put it in there. Because the links are actually a second text hiding beneath the surface of the first. Right. And the way I think of my own posts, that second text is a syllabus. It's like a curriculum. Because if you go through each one and you read each one, you'd have a tremendous amount of knowledge if they're really good links. So that's one connection I see right there between the publishing part of it and the teaching and learning part. And I haven't taught a course yet with blogs. I will soon, and I'll know a lot more about it then, but certainly a lot of potential there. Okay, who's next? We had, yeah. Tell us your names, by the way. I forgot to mention that.
Hi, I'm Tony. I'm a student here at Stanford. I see three reasons from a student perspective as to why academics should blog. The first is, it promotes a lot of more professor-student interaction. If a professor has a blog, a student can understand where that professor comes from much more and understand their thoughts and be able to comment on their blog and vice versa. A professor wouldn't have to spend as much time maintaining student relations by being able to just by virtue of commenting on their blog. The second is research collaboration. There's a big push here at Stanford for interdisciplinary collaboration, but I don't see it happening that often. If there are blogs with each research group has a blog, then it's easy for different research groups to search among the blogs and find research groups that have similar interests or that could potentially collaborate. The third is more along the lines of collaborative workspaces, especially for student groups. Student groups that have blogs can easily publish what they're doing and use it as a communication tool. So those are the three things that I see in the academic world.
Okay, we're still on this first question. Why should academics blog?
My name is Newton Chan. I'm a computer science professor at the local college here. To counter the argument about blogging as a roadblock to students enrolling in the institution. I think blogs has many side effects, and by no means blogging is a substitute of the online pedagogy. It's a tools, one of the tools that we use to convey informations to the students and have the students learn materials. One other side effect of blogging is it's a great way to promote the education institutions as to the quality of the faculty members who blogs. And it, in my experience, it attracts a lot more students.
Yeah, there's one way to display your best people and what they do. Did you have a comment?
I thought I heard so.
Okay. I want to go to the second question, then we're going to open it up to the whole list so you can start thinking of any of those questions you want to answer. Think about which one they are. But I want to start with that second one. What really changes for a faculty member or a student when they start to blog? What's potentially going to change the university itself if blogging becomes part of sort of a standard tool in the academic world? Yes.
I'm Claude. I'm just a programmer. Simple audience. Very simple. You instead of the classic student professor, you've got your everything's carefully coded. You know, everyone knows what the rules are within the academic environment. All of a sudden, out there, anybody can walk in, which is, of course, half the problems in most comments areas. And that's got to change what you're going to express, and especially as you continue the conversation, not just the first post, but the second post that you do on something, or the third, because the ideas you're going to get are going to be a little different.
Right.
Actions.
So that's two different things there. That's one is blogging changes the work for an academic because the audience is potentially worldwide, right? And the second thing is that it's interactive, it's responsive. And so that's going to begin incorporated into what academics do, that feedback
right.
loop.
It's a form of publishing that's less like a lecture, more like a seminar.
Publishing itself will become less like a lecture, more like a seminar. I like that. Okay, what else changes, maybe even changes radically, for academics when they start to blog? Wait for your microphone, thanks.
My name is Chattis. I also just graduated here from Stanford with a degree in economics. Valuation of knowledge changes a lot.
Valuation, say more.
Right now, I mean, it's been hit upon by several different people talking, but the journal system, you know, takes 3-4 months and you get something published, peer review, different things cost, and there's costs associated with that. And now that information is flowing more freely, mm-hmm. it becomes cheaper. I'm not saying this well, but basically, like, the three things of a good market is liquidity, low cost, and I forget the other, I can't think right now, but basically those things are going down for knowledge, and so the cost of knowledge is becoming cheaper.
Right. So this seems to me to be one of the problems. The value for a faculty member of successfully placing an article in an economics journal for publication is partly the difficulty for everyone else of doing the same thing. So the value for an individual is that it's hard to publish in these journals. That's what makes them prestigious. That's what makes your resume, right? And so maybe that will continue to be the case, but the academic world has created ways of finding value in the very limited distribution and access to publication that professors have always had. And so that's disruptive, because right now the economy of scarcity is what creates the prestige rankings of different fields. And so if that expands voluminously, we're going to have a different system of hierarchy, a different system of value, perhaps. Right behind.
Hi, Eli Edwards. I'm a library worker at Stanford University. I suspect one way that, you know, changes for academics, the highfalutin way of saying it would be the dynamic of the discourse. If you're bringing in more people in this much less formal situation than the traditional classroom setting, people are going to respond differently. I mean, for instance, it's not a blog, but I was just on a bulletin board, which got invaded by people who were very jazzed by the re-election of President Bush and started, you know, calling us homos and pinkos and we needed to go back under our rocks and that sort of thing. And that's not just in informal bulletin boards. You're seeing that on blogs as well. And when you're going to have that less civil discourse intruding into the standard discourse, there's going to be some conflict.
Yeah, so you have less insulation and less protection for academic discourse from the rest of the world, correct? Down here.
Oh, well, I was just going to ask, would you compare the role of blogs threatening the role of journalists as gatekeepers to their role as threatening universities as gatekeepers of knowledge?
I think there are parallels to that. In both cases, you have a funnel, you know? You have where information has to funnel down and go through a gate, and then it goes out. So in the case of journalism, the funnel is the editor, right? And that structure, where you have very wide information gathering, it funnels down to a gate or a choke point and then back out, is just being destroyed. So lots of things follow from that. And I think that's the common element between journalism and blogging, because the value added has always been at that choke point. And now there's just many more people at the choke point than there used to be. We'll go over here next.
I want to go back to that idea, a couple questions back, about talking about the value of publishing an article in an academic journal is that it's difficult. And this sort of goes to my publisher perish question also. Isn't or could that be solved partly by reputation systems?
Okay, reputation systems. Say something more about that.
Well, I mean, like on Amazon or on Slashdot or any place where you know lots of people are trying to post, the community basically makes a determination of how the reputation of the speaker or the poster. You know, especially if they do it a lot. You know, somebody whose reputation is high is likely to be taken more seriously as opposed to some whack job who just throws off some crazy idea. Mm. And if the value comes in an academic journal comes from it being difficult, whereas blogging makes anybody able to express an idea, if there's a way for the community to you know, make a value judgment on whether the topic of discussion or the article or the blog posting is good, can that not take the place of the difficulty?
Okay, cool. So there's a reputation system in the academic world already. That's what puts Larry Lessig where he is, right? And there are alternative reputation systems in the blogging internet world. So somebody could write a very interesting article comparing those two things. We don't know what the relationship is, but if you want to do that, then make sure you credit BloggerCon for your idea. Oh.
Yeah, a comment I'd have on this last two points is that whenever something new comes up, I mean, and I've seen this happen, we tend to think of it as, you know, a zero-sum game. Well, this is going to inevitably replace what's there. And I don't think that's necessarily true. There is a value in these academic journals, the top journals having a board of editors in peer review where they look at and judge the quality of articles before they get published. And I don't think that necessarily goes away in a world where anyone can, you know, publish their own blog and put up anything. In fact, I think there may even be enhanced value to that because you do need people to decipher information. You can't possibly, you know, see everything and read everything. And people will naturally gravitate to places that do that for them. And it may be you know, through these this kind of like Amazon way of weighting, you know, the value of people's information, or you know, traditional journals, I think, you know, will also do that. And I think that I think we'll see the same thing in the world of journalism. That you know, the role of editors. I mean, I come from a journalism background, but I don't think the role of editors goes away, and in fact, you know, in some ways, it might be enhanced.
Absolutely, that's definitely true. Peer review is a very valuable system, and probably will maintain itself. But it may be that the peer community expands greatly because of the advantages we have. But peer review, editing, and the ability to reduce information, as against just offer information, are still going to be important, maybe more important than ever.
I agree with that.
So we're opening up now to any of the questions on my list you want to answer. Tell us what the question is first, and then address it.
So yeah, in support of what the previous two people said, I think there would be a lot of value if academic journals were, in fact, to have their own blogs, and I think there would be a lot of value if academics did more of blogging specifically to give their comments about specific articles, which is, you know, an augmentation of the peer review system, essentially.
So tell me how that would work. If I have the Journal of Applied Economics or the American Journal of Sociology, and I assume you're assuming that they're going to be online eventually, right? Some of them are now. But then we'll have a blog, right? So the American Journal of Sociology will have its quarterly issue. You'll be able to find it on the web. But then it'll also have a blog.
Yeah, and
so what's going to happen?
And so presumably, so now something that happens, you know, at least among the people I work with, is often we'll get together, have a meeting, you know, at our institution, talk about a new paper that's come out, and then when we're done, somebody who's made notes about things will send a page-long email to the authors and say, look, we noticed these things about your paper, and they'll respond. Seems to me that, you know, would be better, in fact, if it happened on a blog, and then anybody who reads the journal could look at these discussions.
Hey, fabulous. Good. Yeah. Next. Any of the questions on my list you want to answer, take up, or expand upon, please do. Write down in your notes that everyone's thinking right now.
I want to make sure I had this formulated. A comment coming off here. One of the things, the challenges is going to be, if you're getting more and more academic comment on the internet, through blogs, is a problem that we have to, yes, there are reputation systems, but they tend to get very rapidly outstripped by tools such as Google and some of the linking that goes on there. Basically, most people often don't find a lot of their evaluations of books just by looking at who's the best writer. They go on Google and they get everything, and they sort it out from there. They do it by links. They're doing it by who's getting talked about more. The value system seems to be driven in a much more emergent fashion as opposed to a more structured fashion, which is not the typical academic approach. But the thing that, where I think the journals, the peer review journals, are going to continue to be critical is because they will continue to have the role that the New York Times or the LA Times have in blogging. I mean, when you get down to it in journalism, blogging is not independent. It's very symbiotic. It's dependent upon the main big news sources providing the core information for them to comment on.
Right. Yeah, I think it would be a mistake to assume that blogging is going to overturn the system of academic knowledge production. I don't think that's right at all. In fact, you could argue that the more people are out there talking about economics or talking about sociology, the more important those few peer-reviewed journals become, because they're the only ones who can say what's authoritative, you know, what really counts. Secondly, this Google thing is really fascinating to me. If you're online, put convention coverage into Google and see what happens. Just put convention coverage into Google and press your return key. And you'll see, I hope you'll see. Did it work? Yeah. So now I like, PressThink is the number one site on for that search, right? I could tell you about 20 more, but you get the same result. And this is, to me, this is fascinating. Like, I don't know how I would have done that before. And the reason that post is there is because when I wrote it, it was just when all the bloggers got credentialed to the Democratic Convention. And what I did was I did a whole long history of convention coverage and said that the bloggers now enter upon this history that's kind of like ground to a halt, and they're going to change it, and it's exciting, and I'm going to Boston, and isn't this cool? So that post has about 45 links to it. So it's going to be very hard to dislodge it from that place, right? Because go ahead, try and write a post that gets 45 links. How are you going to do it? Right? You can only do it if it's good, right? Okay, so that's a reputation system. And I get tons of traffic from Google. And sometimes it exceeds the traffic that I get from ordinary links or from people who have me on their blog roll or whatever. So because Google is now the reference system, right? It's almost like the library. It's a whole other way of getting into the library. And if you don't blog, then how can you be the authority on convention coverage? Right? I'm the authority, according to Google. So that, to me, is going to be a huge issue as Google becomes, or if it becomes, the passport to more knowledge on the web. Okay. Any other questions on my list that you want to answer or start to address? Yes.
I'm interested in that style and formatting and potentially the technology question in terms of how we can organize blogs so that it fits better with the organization and the sort of lifestyle of the academic. I think that, what kinds of organization on the blog itself is going to be required so that you have a consistency across academics? And is a consistency something that you'd want to have?
Right.
Is this a universal type system, or is this something that each person has their own personality and it's widely diverse, like the current system, or do you want something that can potentially aggregate it into one format and style so that it is itself a singular academic tool?
Good question. In other words, standard forms and adapting them to the purposes of academic bloggers and creating a sort of an academic standard, because maybe the way that blogging has developed willy-nilly isn't necessarily the best for people in different disciplines, right? And they need a form of their own, possibly. Could you put up Crooked Timber on here? That's a good place for us to get a survey of academic bloggers. How many of you know Crooked Timber? And we'll take a look at that when it comes up. Okay, who's next? Somebody on this side, it was a hand I saw.
May I ask a question? Were you the person who just spoke or asked, were you suggesting an aggregation tool that would take that would take individual and diverse forms of blogging and produce from them a result that is somewhat consistent?
I'd be interested in something that would do both.
Something that would both take the diverse range of bloggers out there, you know, the group of academic bloggers who currently have their range, be able to aggregate something like that, but also to provide a consistent format, something where there's an expectation of what you see from one academic to the next, at least within a particular discipline. Because it seems as though if you don't have the consistency. I mean, the journals and publications, I mean, though they vary widely across disciplines, there's a set standard and there's a set expectation for what you see and how that knowledge is organized. It seems as though it would be good to at least have something to pare down or at least aggregate that diversity that's out there.
Yeah. It's also a question of how do you know that you are a member of a field? How do you know that there is a field? Well, part of it has to do with you have standard forms for knowledge in your field. And that allows you to recognize, oh, that's my field. So that might end up happening. That is, you show as a new political scientist that you're willing to be a political scientist by adopting a political scientist type blog. That's how you do it. That's how graduate students advertise, yes, I'm willing to play by the rules of this discipline. They begin to take on the language of that discipline, the affectations of it. They begin to publish in the forms of that discipline. So maybe that's what will happen. Right? Could you just like click through these blogs by discipline so we can see how they're organized? Just click on different examples. This is all political science, sociology. This is the best list that I know of academic bloggers. Okay, come on over here. Let's just look at some of these as we talk.
What are the?
Could you click on some of these? Like, just go through the historians, click on them, and come back.
Based on what the other gentleman just said, you know, part of the conflict is when you had a traditional content management system that did give you that kind of centralized content publishing and a universal look and navigation and UI, that type of thing. There's also a lot of training that's involved in that, and you have to get a lot of people on board to embrace it. And the whole beauty of blogging is that there's all these different diverse blogging tools, and people gravitate towards those ones that they feel more comfortable with. So I think one of the tasks might be not to do another kind of, you know, top-down system, turn blogging into a content management tool, but to take that and then somehow build in a layer of these different tools, having some kind of universal access or way to view that content in a consistent way without taking the authors and cutting down their freedom of publishing easily.
Yeah. I heard the other day somebody told me that NYU was going to try and standardize all of its web pages. When I heard that, I said, no! You know, but I can imagine what's going to happen is that university say, hey, we got all these bloggers. They're all part of our knowledge factory here, let's brand them all, right? And so you're going to see, you know, Stanford at the top of every blog, and that would be one dumb idea.
Going back
but
to the old system.
Yeah, it's going to happen.
Right across the top there right now. People bar across the top of your website.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah. Okay, let's just keep clicking through. I think this is useful. Okay, somebody else? Did you? Go ahead. Then we'll come around this side.
Tom Clifton. It seems to me we already have a standard form. You know, a stratigraphic listing of posts and a blog roll.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean it's the most effective form for an academic discipline, right?
Yeah.
I mean, for example, why shouldn't you have a little thing, not just a blog roll, but here are my influences. You know, these are the great professors that I have learned from. I can think of a lot of things. You can adapt yourself to this form, but that doesn't mean it's the best form for an individual discipline, and we might see new ones arise.
I'm Paul. It sounds like a lot of what you're talking about is what people refer to as the semantic web. So it's not just you'd list someone and you'd say, this person I'm linking to, I am influenced by them, or I think highly of them, or I think poorly of them, or whatnot. And like the folks from Technorati, I don't work for them, are doing a lot of stuff with that. You see with the election they did vote for, vote against, so you'll see. I saw Dave Siffy around. I know he said Tontek and Kevin Marks are coming later.
They're here, yeah.
But yeah, so perhaps I will get one of the points here is how can academics use a semantic web to help them better communicate and do their jobs or learn or communicate, things like that.
Excellent. Let's go around to this side. How many of you know the notion of an interpretive community? Familiar with that idea? That's the group of speakers and learners who you see yourself as part of. Blogging allows you to advertise what that interpretive community is very easily. That's what my blog role is. These are the people I'm in conversation with. Right? Look at my blog role. These are the blogs that I write about. These are the ones that I read. Now you don't have to guess what tradition I'm in. You just look. There it is. Right? There's the conversation that I'm a part of. You had your hand up behind you.
I'm not in academia, but I'm very curious. One of the reasons I started a blog is these posts are a very efficient way to express an idea, not just, you know, paragraph by paragraph, but you can add so much more context that you can't have in print. You know, instead of footnotes, you can just embed the hyperlink. And instead of clicking through to the hyperlink, you can just hover your mouse over the hyperlink and using the title feature, you know, you can even shortcut it from there. You could take it another step. You could overlay your paragraph over a graphic that, you know, adds more expression to your idea. I'm curious if academia is sort of resistant to making something more entertaining. Does that kind of take away from the prestige an outsider's question?
Oh, there will be resistance for sure. No question about it. There's already resistance. So yeah, there'll be resistance to that. But I'm glad you mentioned that. I was waiting for somebody to mention that. The link is the footnote, updated. That's what a link is. So in that sense, academics could be great bloggers because to be a great footnoter is to be a great linker. Right? And when the founder of the World Wide Web imagined the World Wide Web as kind of an updated library, right? Updated, being able to get something from anywhere in the library dynamically and instantly. Okay, next.
Hello, Eli Edwards again. As a quote librarian, I'm wondering in terms of tools for academic bloggers, what, how we should look at archiving and access for material that's being done now to make sure it's easily accessible and, you know, with subject access in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years.
Absolutely, and that's going to be a huge, huge need. How do you find all this stuff, right? We're creating this huge problem every day by producing so much. We have tools from the old world of print for finding stuff, but the tools now, we just have to keep working on them, and that's going to be a huge problem. Okay, who else?
I have the luxury of writing my own tools in blogging management and all that. I maintain several blogs, which some of them are exclusive blogs within associations. Only members of the associations could read my blog, so I get very high quality feedbacks and sharing of thoughts within the organized group. So I have these tools that when I write something, I could publish in different blogs. Mm-hmm. I found that very useful. It's empowering. So I could editorialize what I want to send out there.
Yeah.
I wonder if that would be helpful for the academic
bloggers.
Empowerment
factor is huge. Huge for knowledgeable people. But that leads me to a question. Let's go over here. In a seminar, we have the ability to say there's a prerequisite for this seminar. There's a prerequisite for this conversation. You can't be in the conversation for the advanced seminar in economic theory unless you've taken basic economic theory. Right? That's a basic tool of organizing knowledge in the university. But how do we do that in blogging? If we want to have a conversation where there's a prerequisite, you have to have read the book. You got to know this. You got to know that. How do you do that? And this, to me, that's one of the biggest problems in blogging right now. Now, one of the greatest things about blogging is that there isn't any prerequisite, right? But it's also a problem because you can't necessarily have the kinds of advanced discussions you want unless you can limit the discussion. How do you limit the discussion? That seems to me to be a huge problem. My comment section, which is a very important part of my blog, is right now is under attack by a troll, by somebody who just won't stop and who wants to bring down the comment section of PressThink. And they're succeeding, because right now the comments are off, because I don't know what to do. So if anybody has and I ban the guy, I ban his domain, his name, you know, nothing works. So this one person, his name is Mark York, and he's a student at California State Fullerton. He has a blog. Nobody reads his blog. And he's destroying this resource. And it's amazing to me that I can't stop the guy. So that's going to be a huge problem. Is barriers to entry are gone. That's what's revolutionary about blogging. That's what's powerful about it. But without any barriers, then you can't have the kind of sophisticated discussions that you might want. So that we don't have a solution to that yet. Maybe the software people will come up with one. But right now, I'm very pissed at the software people because you don't have an answer for this. You know, like, this is terrible. One person able to destroy a discourse community just because he wants to. And I still don't know what to do about it. Okay.
This is almost more of a question, but and it ties off to what you were just talking about, is the amount of time that it takes to maintain a blog, and can it become almost a distraction from what, you know, in some ways is an important role for an academic, which is to do in-depth research. And if you're spending all your time worrying about things like you just described, which is really kind of no value to you and really no value to the institution and to your role as an academic. Because, you know, to have a blog that people are interested in coming to, you have to keep updating, you have to keep pouring stuff into it. And I would think, now I don't have one and I don't know, but I would think it would begin at a certain point to take away from attention that you should be applying to other things.
Absolutely. The number one question people ask me is, where do you get the time to do all this? So unless blogging becomes more integrated into what I'm doing, otherwise, right? Blogging's a part of my teaching. I'm supposed to be teaching. I'm supposed to be researching. Blogging's a part of that. Unless it becomes integrated into the activities of an academic, then it's always going to be this extra thing. And what's going to happen after a while is that academics will start blogging, and then a few months they'll give it up because they can't find the time. And that happens constantly, as you know. So big question. Others? I'm going to go to my list. What time are we going to?
It's a quarter after.
Oh, okay, good. What have we not covered yet?
I may have spaced out, but you began the discussion acknowledging the insularity of media and the insularity of academia and said, so blogging interested you as a means of maybe countering the insularity and communicating outwards.
Right.
That kind of struck me as funny. And that, what about the other half?
What's the other half?
The other way.
People communicating to me.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, sure. I mean, that's constant. As a result of blogging, first of all, I have, 50, 60, sometimes 100, sometimes 200 comments per post from people all over the world. Some of them are people who I might have been inclined to talk to before, but most of them are not. So there's that. And then, of course, I get emails like crazy from people. Some of them are crazy, and some are not. So I think what's going to happen is that academics are going to have all these people examining their work who never examined their work before, saying, what is this? And what do you guys do? What do you do all day in the university? So, and a lot of people in the academic world don't want that. They don't want that. Because the prestige of, at least for faculty, the prestige system in the university depends very heavily on not communicating to wider audiences. It depends on an exclusive discourse that the people in this discipline or sub-discipline speak. And mutually incomprehensible languages are not like a side effect of the academic world. They are integral to the academic world, mutually incomprehensible disciplinary languages. And so the notion that a public audience will now begin to evaluate your work and respond to your work and perhaps even use your work is extremely disruptive for most academic fields. It's not for me because I'm a journalism professor. So the public has always been my domain, my goal. So I'm a little bit unusual in that. But for other disciplines, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen. But the way that they're going to repel the people that they don't want to talk to is through language. It's through an intimidating discourse that most people can't get into. And that's how academic fields do it now. But yeah, it's easier to reach everybody these days, and so people are going to be reached more often than they're accustomed to be.
Of liberal bias, not in media, but in academia. Has that always been around?
It's just part of the culture war.
Nattering nabobs of negativism.
Yeah, nattering nabobs of negativism. Yeah, I get that. After we deal with the media, we're going to deal with you guys. That's what I hear sometimes on my blog.
Speaking of having different dialects across different disciplines, how do you feel about allowing other people to come and translate things that you write and provide translations in different languages and different dialects in English?
That's interesting. Problem would be if I can't check the translation, then I don't want to do it because then I don't have control over what I'm saying. And I could sound like an idiot in Dutch and not know it. So that's the problem. And if I could check the translation, then I wouldn't need the translation. Right?
It takes a lot of time to write something for multiple audiences. You could just write it for one audience and allow people who might not be experts in the field but are at least able to translate out of it to write it for the lay audience or for a 12-year-old.
Yeah, I could. If I didn't care about my language, I could. But as a writer, I care about the way I say things in addition to what I say. And so I just wouldn't do it because I wouldn't be able to control what I'm saying in Dutch or in German. But others might not feel that way. In a discipline where you write up your results, of your research, which is a lot of scientific disciplines are like that, then it wouldn't be a problem. In a discipline where you write and craft your language, it could be a problem. Because I don't write things up, I write them. But it would be interesting to have a worldwide audience. I mean, it'd be fascinating if it could work that way.
Would you be less inclined to use a blogging tool that made it really easy for other people to say, hey, here's my Dutch translation of the last RSS feed?
I really don't know. I have to think about that. That's one of the things I'll puzzle through as a result of BloggerCon. We had somebody else with their hands up. That's really, yeah.
Tim Bishop. I just wanted to say that I thought the fact that academia is sort of being invaded by the non-academicians and that this is a disruptive thing is a good thing. I think the division between academia and ordinary life has grown and grown. If you look at the sociology of academia in this country and the role of the public intellectual, there used to be much more the assumption of the public intellectual being able to talk to the civics, to the people,
yeah.
And the reward system has not rewarded this. But, you know, academia does respond to the market, does respond to, you know, I'm sure that Glenn Reynolds, you know, is looked upon more highly by his colleagues, even though it's not for academic work. And I'm sure that, you know, your name gets more attention in your profession because of PressLink and so on and so forth. And I think this is a positive development. And, you know, while I can imagine lots of resistance, I can't really imagine it carrying the day, but I don't know.
It will carry the day. I'll tell you where you'll see whether it carries the day or not. And it's in what somebody said before. What do faculties and universities regard as acceptable work for tenure and promotion? That's what it's going to come down to. And if it isn't expanded to include other forms of publishing, then that's how the resistance will take place. Because what people have to do to survive is going to be their orientation. And if blogging is part of that, then that's going to be part of their orientation. And if it's not, right now the way it is it's probably, for me, it's a benefit. But for other people in other disciplines, it's either a zero benefit or actually a negative. Because you're talking out of school. You're talking out of your discipline. You don't have the controls on you that you might otherwise.
I can see that, especially for the sciences and so on. But for people who are policy. You know, people who are doing law, who are doing government, people who are doing sociology and so forth. And also, I assume the market will work, right? If somebody at an institution is not getting recognition for the work, but is getting recognition in the outside world and could perhaps attract students, make the university have a slightly bigger name, or make a small college elsewhere have a slightly bigger name, you know, get it more in the press. I mean, I think academia is becoming more marketing savvy at the same time and is facing the same pressures the rest of us are facing, you know, in the world.
Yep. In that sense, it could be. Absolutely. Could work that way. Let's go over here. Did you have your hand up?
You made a comment earlier that as a writer, you're concerned about not only what you write, but how you write. And I can certainly appreciate that. And having done some writing myself, I share it. But trying to say, I don't want people to translate my stuff, and therefore I'm going to make it hard for them, is not going to work. Because what's going to happen is someone will feed it through Babelfish, and you'll get a translation that's an order of magnitude worse, right? So it's like, this is one of these Cory Doctorow arguments where you say, you know, you're trying to stop the internet, and it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, you can either realize that somebody who doesn't speak English is going to want to read your stuff, and you can sort of help that happen, or you can get in the way.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting. Maybe I will have to do that. It's definitely possible. You ever had, sometimes I see it already, somebody takes in the entire post that I wrote, like 3,000 words, and just puts it on their blog. What the fuck? But how am I going to stop them? I can't stop them. Did you have your hand up? I thought you'd, sorry, your hand. Who else did? We haven't heard from you. No? Who else? Go ahead. Go ahead, and then we'll move.
If somebody's copying your post, presumably you don't need to stop them, really, because
I don't really need to,
everybody man. Who matters, I guess, to you is going to know that you wrote that post.
Yeah, but so I want them
to
come to my house.
The attribution is based on your reputation.
I want them to come to my house.
Well,
I want to come to somebody
else's
house.
They will if you know, Google works the way it's supposed to and all the web bloggers link to your post originally. They're going to find your post first.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, the reputation is built around Google, and you just don't need to worry about people copying your stuff.
Yeah, except that what happens when somebody who steals posts becomes you know, very popular for stealing really good posts, and people flood that site, and that's where they find you. And they never go, it's possible. It's possible.
Possible, but unlikely.
Do you?
Hasn't happened yet that I know of.
All right, fair enough. Okay, let's move over here, and then we'll go back here.
I just want a quick comment. You should alert them. You should just email them back and just say.
Sometimes I do, yeah.
We've been not web blogging, but magazine blogging, I guess, online since 98. So it's never really happened except for maybe one or two times. But, well, you know, a little nice little email says, what's up here?
Sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't.
You mentioned just a moment ago about you want people to come to your house. And
yes.
Just to ask you about that, there are tens of millions of people around the world who can't get to the houses that people have built on the traditional wired web because they have mobile devices and they're getting the internet from mobile internet. So they can't get to your house. So there's all sorts of new things going on with RSS and how to publish and access it to these different devices. So do you say, if you're on the web, I want you to come to my house, but if you're not on the web, it's okay? What? How does it all kind of...
Don't know. I haven't gotten that far. Good question. Right now, I want them to come to my house because I built it for them. So, but I see what you mean. Syndication is really the opposite of blogging in a way.
Someone needs to learn from you or get your information, and they can't get to your house. So,
yeah.
How do we open it up to those people?
It's a good question. I don't necessarily want to reach everybody in the world. That's not my necessarily my goal, but I see your question. Let's go there and then here.
I just wanted to talk about students and about the fact that, you know, in this age, what students do at school is they make digital media, like in the form of Word documents or other kinds of media as well. but it's all digital, and it's all already there. It's on their computers, but it's all sort of closed off. And I'm just wondering what the value might be and what kinds of emergent effects might take place and how it might interface with blogging if those papers were somehow available, if not to everyone, at least to their peers, whether that could produce better papers by virtue of the social pressures, but whether blogging or blogs is really the place for those to reside, or whether, because something about like grabbing my 2,500 words and, you know, throwing them up there, or my even longer, and just putting them in a post, it doesn't necessarily seem to be the right format for that sort of thing. And so, you know, just I'd be curious what you think about sort of opening up sort of student publication to the academic process.
Could be the biggest boon to plagiarism ever, right? I mean, that's basically what you're suggesting could be possible. There's that. There's also this other effect, which Rebecca Blood writes about this. In the past, there's always been this barrier, this hurdle you go through before you can put something in the form where it looks finished and published, right? It was expensive to do that. And now, it's not. So everything looks finished and published. It looks that way, even if it's not. And I think this is part of the problem, is how do we differentiate between things that are ready for publication because they have been labored over, and those that just look it. And so for students, I think there's very limited value, and as you put it, you know, throwing something up on the web. There's not much value in that. But the idea that students can be publishers of their work, that is important. But you have to figure out that step of how do I make this ready for publication. And it's so easy to put it up that, you know, you almost have to build something in that's more of an internal discipline. Because you don't, what I would want to teach students is don't make something published until you've worked on it, until it's ready for the public, right? And so that's how I see that problem.
Want to put your crap online
either. Yeah, but people do that already, you know? That's a big problem. It's too easy. When something's too easy, the value of doing it goes way, way down.
Jay, we're out of time.
We're out of time, right? Right, okay. I don't want to say there's any one big lesson here, but we explored how disruptive this technology, this medium, can be to an institution that has built its entire self on the control of knowledge. That's what a university is. It's a way of controlling, producing, maintaining knowledge. Universities have never been great in the distribution biz. That's not what they're good at. They're good at holding knowledge, refining it, controlling it. And blogging, in that sense, is an attack on the DNA of the university. I think we'll see great resistance to blogging, and then I think we'll see some people really absorbing it and transforming themselves with it. And we'll see attempts to just graft blogging onto the academic institution, thinking it won't really change much at all. We'll see a lot of that as well. That's as far as we've gotten today. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Academia Session from BloggerCon 3, held at Stanford University, November 6, 2004. My name is Doug Kay, and I hope you'll join me next time for another edition of IT Conversations.